Hello, everyone, and welcome to our second week of our Yoga Teacher Survival course. Our topic this evening is making money. Now, one question I hear very often from new teachers or people who are thinking of just taking a teacher training is whether or not it's actually possible to make a good living as a yoga instructor. There are so many pieces to this answer. You know, this alone, this one topic could be a six-week course all in and of itself, and that may be something that we do in the future. But more than anything else, I do want to reassure everyone that it is possible to make a really good living as a yoga instructor if you know how to do it. So yoga, just like anything else, is a business. And although it may be our passion, although it may be our lifestyle, one thing that we really need to start to get okay with is our relationship to money and our relationship to money as it pertains to our business. Whether your goals as a teacher are to do this for fun or just part-time, or whether you are hoping to make your career out of this and do this as your full-time job, I find a lot of us come into teaching with previously ingrained ideas surrounding money. Depending on your cultural background, your upbringing, your parents' relationship to money, you may have been taught that money must be hard-earned, that it only comes to people who are lucky or corrupt. Or the favorite phrase, of course, that I'm sure we've all heard from one at one point or another, is that money doesn't grow on trees. You may believe that making a lot of money also is the only way to find happiness. You may believe that money is what helps you thrive in life, and that at a certain point, when you make a certain amount of money, you will be able to truly be happy and be relaxed and have everything you want. We all know that money is important. Money is the key that helps you to determine so many aspects of your lifestyle. I was pleased to hear from so many of you about the visualization last week, and I'm glad that it helped you to start to get clear on who you wanted to be as an instructor and what your ideal student really looks like. One thing we didn't talk about so much was last week in the visualization. Before we did the ideal student and the ideal teaching self, I asked you to begin by imagining your ideal living space. Just take a moment. Remember what that was. What was your lifestyle like? Whether yoga is a part-time or full-time venture for you at this point in your life, knowing the kind of life you want to live must be congruent with your career goals, because if you imagined driving to your teaching space in a $100,000 car, but your ideal class was a pay-what-you-can drop-in at the Y, then these two things kind of don't line up, and it may not be a realistic pursuit. To perhaps complicate this relationship with money that you may already have, in comes the so-called spiritual world of yoga. In the yoga world, the topic of money is a confusing and shadowed one. The quickest way to get a room full of yoga instructors to clam up and shut down is to start talking about money. Your personal connection with money is definitely going to be underscored with many different emotions, beliefs, and also throw in whatever you've been taught by your yoga community or your yoga mentors. More than once, I've heard teachers and students, in fact, say that teaching for money is negative and greedy, and that yoga should be free for everybody. Because yoga, after all, isn't about that. And I definitely won't sit here with all of you and say that I'm free from strange limitations and relationships with money. But it's definitely a lot different than it was early in my teaching career. In my early teaching days, I almost refused to handle or discuss money. When teaching at a studio, I resisted taking money at the front desk, and I would intentionally make myself scarce whenever students were paying for their class package. The interesting thing is, I'm not really sure where that came from. At my 9-to-5 job, I certainly felt more than fine getting a paycheck at the end of the month. But taking money to teach yoga somehow felt very, very different. Now, I don't want to start a conspiracy or start drawing lines between yoga studio owners and independent teachers, but I will suggest that the perpetuation of the belief that yoga teachers shouldn't make too much from teaching happens to be very lucrative for many studios. Now, where I happen to teach at the one studio that I teach at here in Hamilton, we're actually very lucky. We have better wages than a lot of other studios that I know of. But it is very disheartening to see that many of the big-name yoga schools require teachers to teach for free for months on end until you can build a studio following and, quote-unquote, prove your worth. So a lot of these studios are asking teachers to give up their time and energy to prove themselves to the studio and the community. And yet, students are still paying top dollar for those classes. So studios are profiting off the fact that people really do love to teach yoga and want to teach yoga. And as such, they can make these requirements. So I just, I would say that we touched on this slightly last week in some of your comments about finding your right yoga community. But if you're going to teach for a studio that takes thousands of dollars from teacher trainees and then gets them to work for free for months on end, you know, that relationship with money doesn't feel good. It probably won't feel quite right to you, and you might do it just for the opportunity to teach, but right away, I would say that's a red flag. I intentionally don't attend studio classes at places that don't pay their teachers. And that would be something that you would want to ask about when you're considering taking on a job at a certain space. Somewhere along the line, many of us are taught that taking money or talking about money is somehow un-yogic. Most teachers I know, even ones who've been teaching for 15 plus years, would never dream of asking for a raise for their class. A brand new teacher and someone with 20 years of experience end up making the same rate for classes because that is somehow fair and just, according to a lot of studio owners and a lot of yoga schools. In reality, keeping things even across the board means that a big chain studio or school can justify paying senior teachers less because they pay the same rate to everyone. And to be honest, newer teachers are always willing to take less money because they so desperately want to teach a class. They feel like they're being rewarded in other ways. However, the underlying message that sends is that we never learn as instructors to ask for more if we believe that we're worth it, because we know we're replaceable. We know that there's someone right there waiting to take over our class and will happily do it and teach it for half the price. Beliefs about money also influence how money comes into our lives. For instance, all of you made an investment to take part in a course like this, and that was with the intention that you want your business to be successful and not burn you out. But there are many other teachers I know that really, really desperately need a course like this, but they weren't willing to invest in such a thing because they were more interested in taking the next workshop to get an idea about a new flow they can teach in class. Of course, continuing our education in yoga is beautiful and wonderful, and we should always be striving to do that. But the fact is that many teachers believe through and through that having a successful class, and therefore a successful business, is simply about them getting better as teachers and has nothing to do with getting people in the door who are willing to try you out. Getting people in the door is a huge deal. When they try you out, they fall in love with your class because you're simply being a bright shining star, and that's who you are. It doesn't have everything to do with the flow. It doesn't mean that you say everything perfectly all the time. Getting people into class is a big, big deal. You could be the best teacher in the world, but if no one comes to your classes because you don't know how to market yourself, promote yourself, you're not teaching at the right times, or so many of the other things we discussed last week, no one's going to be there. If you don't know how to get people in the door, you're never going to build up that following and therefore grow your business. So what I want to do right now is give you about 5 minutes to reflect on some of the blockages that you may be carrying about money and your own self-worth. I'm going to have you just write down, maybe there was something I said that you can truly relate to. So as you're writing, think about what some of these deeply held beliefs might be from your own family history, from your own experience in your life, and maybe some of the more deeply ingrained beliefs that you got from the yoga community that you're a part of. I'm going to give you a few minutes now, and we'll come back. Okay, everyone. Let's come back, and now you should have a short list, or maybe a very long one, of some of the deeply held beliefs around money, the blockages that may be holding you back. Now, I wish I could just wave a magic wand and get rid of all of those for you, but this is going to be a process. And the most important part of this process first is just identifying what you may be holding on to and what may be working on an unconscious level. The most important thing I want to relieve you all of tonight is feeling guilty about doing what you love and getting paid for it. If you consider that most professionals get paid behind the scenes. When you go to a shop or a store, you pay for the items, but you're not handing the person who sold you the watermelon a check for their salary. When you go see a concert, you don't go up to the drummer at the end of the night and hand them cash for their role in the show. However, when you teach a private yoga class, your students put your paycheck in your hand at the end of each session or block. In all of these scenarios, someone pays for something. But in the first two examples I gave you, you're directly paying for an item or an experience. And in the last, you're giving money directly to someone else and their lifestyle. I can give you an example of how this kind of works and how it can be a little bit weird in our own lives. So recently, my car came up for the end of its lease. And I loved my little car, but the winter was really horrible for it, and it got stuck in the snow one too many times. I had to be dug out by other people. I had to be driven places by other people. And it was a really big pain, and it was directly affecting my life. So for the first time, I decided not to lease a new car, but to buy one. And my partner, who you'll all get to meet in a few weeks, who's going to be helping us with the marketing, he is 6'4", and he subtly asked if I could get a car that he could sit in without hitting the roof. So even though my new car is far from a luxury vehicle, I feel a pang of resistance and shame each time one of my private clients asks, "Hey, did you get a new car?" Now, I can't totally be sure that this is all entirely my stuff, because much of the world is programmed to think that yoga teachers should be living very simply, which, of course, we all know is the polite way of saying yoga teachers should be poor. I know that some of my students think that because they're getting some kind of spiritual kick from me, that I shouldn't be driving around in a new car. Nonetheless, the feeling of my own resistance and shame about that showed me that there was something there that I needed to pay attention to. And I needed to pay attention to it so that I didn't start sounding apologetic or trying to blame my partner's height or doing anything but saying, "Yes, I did, I got a new car," rather than having to explain that, "Oh no, I'm still a very humble yoga woman." So these subtle tugs around our self-worth and shame come up a lot around money. And today is the day I want to relieve you of the mindset that money for us is going to happen behind the scenes. You are all entrepreneurs, and at some point you are going to have to handle cash at different classes. You are going to be paid by your students. And it's time to stop feeling bad about that. Every time you cash a check, every time someone hands you money for your service, this is how you and your business survive and grow. Your mantra should be here: if you can't eat, you can't teach. We as instructors are supposed to be, ideally, the shining beacon of health and wellness and wisdom. And it doesn't mean that we're perfect, certainly. We don't want to come across as anything but humble and continuing our own journey. But being on your own journey is very, very inspirational to other people. What is not inspirational to other people is seeing somebody suffer who is not really all together with their lifestyle, that can't take care of their basic needs. So you don't want to be worse off than the people you're teaching. This is something that I remember hearing when I went to school for acupuncture, is that you should never look worse than the person that's coming in to see you. So if your patient looks healthier than you do, there's a problem. Now, all of that being said, I want to give you a few ideas on how to deal with money if this pep talk I'm giving you hasn't worked yet. It will work, it just does take time. So a few ideas that you can start to implement that will help get you beyond this weirdness around money if that is something that you are dealing with. First of all, if you're working at a yoga studio that doesn't have someone working at the desk and then you are therefore responsible for taking money, of course it is not ideal, but it does help because you're simply following studio protocol, which means people come in, they pay you for class, you put the money where it's supposed to go, and there doesn't have to be any weirdness around that. If there's any questions that come up, you are an employee, a contract employee of that studio, doing part of your job. And you just think of the teaching time as being the time that you're working at the desk until the time your class is over. If you are teaching private classes, the way that I like to deal with money with my private classes is to get students to pay in blocks or sessions. I go into this a little bit more in the private yoga ebook that I'm going to send to all of you. But 6 or 10 class sessions are the best because they, first of all, ensure a commitment from your students. It's a large enough chunk of money that people really feel the weight of that and know that they have to show up week after week and they can't be flaky. If you're only taking, you know, $30 or $40 at a time from people, they're going to be much less apt to remember to bring you money when they're supposed to. They're going to be less committed to the entire session. They're going to be a little flakier from my experience. So getting people to pay in significant chunks of money usually is the best. It reminds them that they are taking a class and that this is the way that it is. Now, a few ways you can keep things really simple is you can calculate what that 6 or 10 block session is going to be ahead of time. You can get everyone to PayPal you the money or send you money via email banking. And if you have this small group class, part of your initial agreement with the host of the class could be that they collect all the money at the beginning of a 6 or 10 week session, and you have them hand you everything at once in an envelope, and that's as clean as you can possibly make it. Above all, in any conversation you're having about money, whether it's with a studio owner as you negotiate a salary, whether it is with a host of a small group or private session, never approach money from an angle of being apologetic. You're not taking their money. You're providing a service that costs a certain amount, and you are going to do everything you can within that scope, within your yoga time together, to give them a great experience, to help them be healthier, to help keep them safe. You're going to bring all of your expertise, all of your experience into the room. Think about their money as they pay you as coming in to help you continue to simply exist. It helps your business exist. It helps your own lifestyle exist. So we want to take away a lot of the shadows around money and accepting that. Because our goal here is not simply to eat, but to grow as a human and to grow as a business. Another topic I wanted to spend a little bit of time on as I mentioned in the modules, is actually time management. So what we're going to sort of start to tie in is how we set different rates and how we figure out what to charge for classes. In the bonus audio, you'll hear that one of the biggest problems that studio owners complain about is teachers with bad time management skills. So as yoga teachers, especially if you're more of a full-time teacher, your lifestyle is probably a little bit all over the place. We're constantly running to different places at different times. Sometimes your classes are early in the morning. Sometimes the classes are late at night. And I see this as well a lot with teachers is rushing in at the last minute, rushing out to get to the next place, and really creating a lot of unnecessary stress for ourselves around timing. If you are a poor time management planner, there are two tools that I would say everyone should be using. And you may already have a great system. If you're very organized, then stick with what works. But here are my favorite two important time management tools. The first one is a calendar. It may sound silly, but I have a Google Calendar as part of my Gmail that I put every single thing that is scheduled in my life into. Even if you have a really consistent, ongoing schedule, if you don't write it down, chances are you are going to mess things up from time to time. There are classes I've literally been teaching for 5 years, and they still go in my calendar. If you don't have a calendar, it will change your life. It will really be the best thing. And there's actually a really great book called Getting Things Done by David Allen. And one of the points that he makes in his book is that you never want to undermine your calendar, which means you schedule things and you do them. You don't start scheduling things and then moving them till tomorrow, moving them to next week. Only things that you're actually going to get done during that day, appointments you're actually going to make, classes you're going to teach, paperwork that must be done goes into your calendar. This is so important. Set yourself up for success here. Never undermine the calendar and use it every day for everything. The second important time management tool is a to-do list. Now, you may have tried working with lists before and perhaps they don't work. That same David Allen book, I would really recommend. It's a great productivity book. But essentially, what is so wonderful about it is that it does ask you to compartmentalize things on a list in ways that you'll actually get them done, hence the title of the book. So my to-do list, I keep it in my iPhone, and I have an app called Wunderlist, which I can send out to all of you. And I basically have a few categories. I have a category called at the computer. Phone calls would be the list of people I need to phone. Errands or shopping would be anything I do need to pick up when I'm at a store. And I find that categorizing your list, your to-do list in this way really does help because all of a sudden you're not scanning through 10 different lists, you're not trying to find things in different places, and you're not trying to use your mental energy to remember all of the things that you're probably forgetting at any given point. Your list is actually going to be the biggest relief to your mind. One other category I'd say that's really important is a must-be-done-today item in your list. So whether it's your app, whether it's on your calendar, the things that are essential, the things that must get done today, put those somewhere that you will see them, keep checking them, and even set aside a block in your calendar for your day so that those things actually do happen. The busier you are as a yoga teacher, the more energy you're going to need to conserve, And these two tools, as simple as they are very sophisticated when it comes to helping with our time management and helping us really work optimally so we can use our time, energy, and focus on the things that matter, like our lives and our classes and our families. One of the nice things about getting better as a time manager is that you can start to relate this back to the idea of making money. So what I would say, one of your homework pieces for this week is to actually keep track of the time it takes for you to walk out of the door, drive or walk over to the space you teach in, teach your class, and get to the next place you go to. What I find so interesting is for most people, this is at least a 2 to 2.5 hour process. And when we go back to looking at feeling maybe a little bit ashamed about asking for money for our classes or thinking that maybe we're asking for too much for classes, considering how much time and energy it actually takes you to get where you're going does come into play. Now, I'm certainly not suggesting that everybody goes out to the place that they teach at and demand that they get a raise tomorrow. But what I would like you all to start doing is actually taking into account your time versus the money that you're making. Now, if you're very comfortable making $15 to teach a class because it's so much fun and you're getting a lot out of it, there's nothing wrong with that and you should continue to do so. But as you continue to teach more and more, and if this is becoming something that you rely upon to pay the bills, while it may not be realistic that you're going to make $70 to teach a studio yoga class, what really matters is that when you start to take on private or small group classes, that you are not afraid to ask for the appropriate amount of money for your time, for your transportation, and for your energy. This also comes into play when you're doing things like promoting workshops and taking time to reach out to students. I've met teachers that feel very guilty taking a nice paycheck home at the end of a workshop because they feel like, oh, well, I made several hundred dollars for only teaching for 2 hours of time. But when you consider how much of your lead time went into that, how many students you had to talk to, how much work went into planning your workshop, it actually works out to be probably more appropriate than you would imagine. I'm going to send out a few other suggestions about time management. Specifically, there's another one I'd like to talk with all of you about called batching, which is probably something that you already do. But I'll save that for an email later on this week. For now, your calendar, your to-do list, and really keeping track of your time versus your money is your work. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of this call, this is a very, very full topic, and there's only so much we're going to be able to fit into our limited time together. But we're going to do one more thing. In this module, I mentioned that part of the way that we're going to learn how to make money is by learning how to get more classes and teach workshops. Again, if I had a magic wand, I would wave it over all of you so that this just happened for you tomorrow. But tying in with the conversation we've been having tonight about self-worth, about self-esteem, about money, about our blockages that are perhaps surrounding those issues, what we're going to work on now is our 30-second elevator speech. So I know some of you have done this before, but an elevator speech is basically, if you walked into an elevator with another person and they said, oh, hi, what do you do for a living? You would want to be able to give them a really clear, concise idea about what you do and what you have to offer by the time the elevator door opens again. So this is usually like a few sentences or 30 seconds long. And what I really want to stress is that this is more than just a bio. If you go on yoga teaching websites, you'll see a lot of people with very long bios that lists all of the different trainings that they've done, all of the workshops they've attended. Now, as another yoga instructor, you might find that very interesting. I always like to know who other teachers are studying with. But the truth is, students find those bios pretty boring. Most people don't read bios on yoga websites, and reading someone's bio doesn't usually attract them to the teacher. So what your elevator speech is not going to be is, oh, hi, my name is Erin. Yes, I've done a 250-hour teacher training, and then I did another one in Montreal a few years later, and I've studied with this teacher and that teacher, and I like to teach da-da-da-da-da. What's wrong with that bio is that it's all about me. What your elevator speech, what a really good one should be, what your 30-second introduction should be if it's going to be effective, is about the person you're trying to help. We really spent a lot of time thinking about our ideal student. What does your ideal student want to know? They probably don't care who you did a workshop with last summer, because chances are your ideal student has no idea who that is. So we want to start to write our bios or write our 30-second elevator speeches, not for ourselves or for other teachers, but for our students. I have a teacher friend in the U.S. who had a near-death experience, and yoga was part of his rehabilitation. You know, his passion about yoga really helped him to heal from this very scary experience and a lot of very serious injuries. So when he talks about why he's interested in yoga or why he likes yoga, it's a very compelling story. But it's more than just a story. He can personally, through his own experience, talk about the benefits of yoga from his own rehabilitation. So if his ideal students are people that have had injuries and don't think that they'll be able to do incredible things with their bodies ever again, he's living proof that yoga can help you to heal. His ideal students will be very attracted to that. I love teaching regular people. My ideal student is not someone that's floating around in white robes. It's, you know, the average person. So sometimes when I meet someone who's intimidated by the idea of taking a yoga class, I tell them that I hated yoga the first time I took it. Which is true. I did not like my first few classes. I was very competitive with the other people in the room. I actually had been a dancer, so I felt like I needed to be able to do everything perfectly, and I really did not enjoy it. But when Shavasana came and I could just let go, that was what was very compelling to me and had me coming back over and over and over again. So it's not wrong to speak a little bit about yourself and your own journey with yoga, because that is very compelling and it can be very relatable for a lot of people. What is equally as important is telling people what you do for them. What makes you stand out as a teacher? What does your ideal student want to know about? Is your ideal student an athlete? If so, when you're talking to them about what you do, and you work with athletes, and that's your interest, you say, I help athletes find optimum performance and better recovery time. If you love to work with new mothers, or you're a prenatal yoga teacher, when you find yourself standing in front of a woman who is newly pregnant, you can tell them what prenatal yoga does, or how it helps, or why you're interested in it. Your elevator speech, and not trying to not put it in cheesy terms, it really is your pitch. And I have to say that although this sounds like a simple thing, most yoga teachers are just terrible at doing it. We are not really the best self-promoters in the world. And sometimes when we try to be, it can come off as very inauthentic. What will help your authenticity is just getting comfortable with saying it. So yet another thing we're going to work on this week is giving our elevator speech to as many people as possible. If you want to know how to get private classes and workshops, this is the key. Having a good elevator speech, one that is true and authentic, is the key to getting things like privates and workshops. I've met people, talked to them for 5 minutes, and been hired for classes I've taught for now 3 to 4 years. Every week, same people. Now, it didn't happen because I'm some great saleswoman and because I made them an amazing deal or I offered to teach them for free. It's because I happened to find my ideal students somewhere out in life or at a party. And we talked about what their goals were, what their needs were. And I talked about my interest in working with those things. And those have become long-term clients. So if you want to know how to get private classes and workshops, being able to speak about yourself with confidence, if you're able to speak about their interest and mention that you also teach private classes, the people who want their needs met will work with you. They will want to work with you. They will be begging to work with you. So what we're going to do this week is create a pitch, a 30-second elevator speech that is geared towards your ideal student. It's your story, but not your bio, and how you could meet their interest. You can talk about other people you've helped, as long as you don't name names. You want to keep your private clients confidential as much as possible. And a few ways where you can take this opportunity. I mentioned that you can just do it out in life, but there are a few key places that will help you to get private classes. First of all, if you're not bold enough to go up and start offering your services to everyone you know, you could offer to do a 15-minute assessment. People do make off-the-cuff remarks when you start to say that you're a yoga teacher. They say things like, oh, I'll have to try that, or sometime I'll come to your class. You know, get people to put their money where their mouth is, and if you're not confident doing that, get them to give you 15 minutes to talk it over. Now, another way, if you are teaching public classes, to find private clients is to look within the pool of people you're already teaching. Of course, you always want to check with the yoga studio that you're working with and make sure that you're okay to mention that you teach private classes, because you don't want to step on toes and you do want to be very clean and clear about how that works. But when students come up to you at the end of class and ask a question, if it's something that that involves a little bit more of an explanation, offer to do a private class with them. Again, perhaps you're asking for half price. Maybe you're going to do a half an hour for $45, and you can work on their specific issue. That, again, has often turned into long-term classes for me. I mentioned workshops in this module a little bit, but workshops are great if you're looking to find more classes or private classes. And you can get very creative with this. If you happen to want to work with athletes, maybe you can send an email to a running group that you know, or have a friend who has a team of runners that they work with. Maybe you offer them to do a discounted 30-minute private session the week before or after a race. Workshops are a great funnel for private classes, and often you find your ideal students there because you're teaching what you love and they're interested in that. So again, private classes are probably a lot easier to find than you imagine. But the elevator speech is a huge, huge part of that. And we are going to be working on that a lot this week. What I would